The 1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 253, The Ideal of Church Management, with Bjorn Christensen. Comments by Larry DePadova Stocks.
Oh, good, good, okay. This afternoon we have Bjarne Christensen, who is that is Danish, and Mr. Christensen actually moved here to the United States at the age of 18. He was born in Denmark. He has a BS at the University of Utah in business and economics. He was a fellow office management association. He's had a lot of years in corporate management positions. He's worked for two Fortune 500 companies and 20 years in private business. He's published a number of articles in various business markets, and then it has a number of publications that he's listed as having published in, none of which are under the area of business. So they were listed The Ensign, The New Era, The Gourmet, Magazine Travel and Leisure, The New York Times, which I imagine are other than your regular business publications. Perhaps you could elaborate a little bit on that. Afterwards, we'll have comments by Larry DePadova Stocks, and who married Hugh Stocks just 5 weeks ago. She has just moved here from Albany, where she just recently did her PhD in the graduate science of public affairs, and she was doing her field of research in organizational hierarchy and leadership. Did I miss something? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had a comment. And she is an assistant visiting professor of political science at the University of Utah at the moment. And afterwards, we'll have some time for questions, and I'll let them go ahead and field questions themselves.
Wait. Hold it. Until I'm done, then you can whistle at me, do whatever. Can you all hear back there? Is the microphone on? Okay. My name is Bjarne Christensen. As was said, I'm a business person. I'm not really an academic, and so I feel a little bit out of place, essentially. I wrote this paper as a result of being very frustrated. One afternoon I came home from my Sunday meetings, and I sat down and started to write out a number of things. And the paper grew, and over a period of a few months, it got to the state of where it's in now, which is way too long to read. I buried it for a couple of years in a file, and then one day brought it back out. We were changing some file drawers around. My wife found it. And we read through it, and my wife said, gee, this is pretty good stuff. You ought to submit this to somebody. I said, well, I can't send this to the Ensign, you know, or anything like this. So where do I go? She said, why don't you send it to Sunstone? And so I did, and so they invited me to present the paper today, which I'm very grateful for, because it's kind of fun to do. But it is a little out of my league, maybe. But on the other hand, I think the paper is fairly well written. And I do have about 15 copies of the paper. If any of you are interested afterwards, you know, you're more than welcome on a first-come-first basis. I'm not going to bash anybody, least of all the general authorities. I think they have their hands full with, you know, everything that they do. And what I'm going to comment on mainly, I think, is a culture that has invaded the church. And because primarily of what Nibley calls the switch or the change from leadership to a management caretaker type leadership that has happened in the church over the last 20, 30 years. And so we'll try to maybe talk about some of the consequences of what has happened because of that. Because I'm in business, I have for a long time been interested in organizational management. And I have tried to keep up on the literature, not on an academic basis, but just basically for my own benefit. And since I think most of you are not involved with business management, what I would really like to do first, and just take a minute or two, to just go through the basic business cycle from an organizational standpoint. And when I speak about business, I'm talking about organizations. Because I don't think it matters whether you're a small business that's starting out or in any other type of organization, whether it's a nonprofit or a church or whatever. And basically, there are three stages in a business organization. When you first start out and you're an entrepreneur, you do whatever is necessary to get that business going and get the organization moving. There are no hierarchies. the owner of that business works there as long as is necessary to get that business going. My good friend Nils Jensen is here. He lives in Salt Lake City. He's the owner and manager of Jensen Reproduction Company. When he first started out, I was in college at the U. And he was a young man who was a great salesperson. And he had been kicked out from, or had decided to start his own business because the owner of the business he was working for decided he was making too much money. So he was trying to cut his sales commissions. And Neil said, well, I can do this myself. So he went out and started a business. And he hired me as a helping hand. And I would like to have a dollar, and I'm sure Nils would too, for every night that we were down at his plant making blueprints for Sperry, Utah, Sargent Missile, because they required millions of prints. And we were down there till 2 o'clock in the morning, and then we usually hit McDonald's or something like that on the way home. And this was after we had gone to school and done all the other things. That's how a business starts. That's how an organization starts. If you look at the church, it was the same thing. There weren't any real hierarchies when the church first started. But as it grew, then little by little, you start adding on a hierarchical structure. You need managers, department heads, and sooner or later, you'll have a book of operations, a manual that everybody goes by. Now, the business and the organization can still continue to grow until such a time when it becomes very, very large. If you want to, afterwards, we can talk about some of the companies in today's news that are huge and supposedly very well managed, like an IBM, that still isn't cutting it. And there are simple reasons for that. They have created a culture that is almost impossible to change. Now, if you look at the church, I think that's exactly what has happened to the church. We're through the second stage of growth, this rapid, rapid growth that many organizations have in the second stage. And we're now right going into the third stage where it's very, very difficult to manage. If you look at an organization with 10 million people, and the hierarchical structure wants to control and make sure that everybody does, you know, on, you know, the same step, it's a very, very difficult thing to manage. It's, in fact, almost impossible. And so now we see what's happening in the church is that there's a retrenchment in many ways in communication. We're building a bureaucracy. Conformity reigns the day. And so forth. There are many, many things that you can see that happens in organizational structures that is now, I think, happening to the church. One of the things I think that is a crucial issue in the church is that church members identify leadership with management. And I think that's very, very crucial, that we have to see the differences, that there is a difference. And one of the things I would like to do today is to show you what the differences are in real true leadership versus management. Nibley at BYU first identified this, I think, back in the 80s, when he talked about this at the, I think it was 1983 graduation of BYU, in front of all the general authorities. This is what he said. He says there was a cultural decline in the church as a consequence of a gradual shift from leaders to managers. He went on to state that leaders are movers and shakers, original, inventive, unpredictable, imaginative, full of surprises, which is true for leadership. I lost my place. Full of surprise, the discomfort, the enemy in war, and the main office in peace. And that's true, isn't it? Managers, however, he continued, are safe, conservative, predictable, conforming organizational men and women dedicated to the establishment. While leaders enjoy a passion for equality, managers find this principle repugnant and counterproductive. The dominance of managers is associated with inordinate materialism in which the value is equated with price. Thus, the manager who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing, because for him the value is the price, said Nibley. I think that's true, and I think that's what has happened. If you would put out the first little overhead that my son made at the expense of Hewlett-Packard, that's not the one, honey. Get down. I'm sorry. Leadership. That's right. There you go. Okay. Can you read it? Leaders are never satisfied with the status quo. That is exactly what managers like, is the status quo. You know, in an organization like the church, and I've served in a number of bishoprics and high councils and things like this, like most of you have probably, and you know as well as I do that you never spend any time on the future. You're always spending time on problems, and when you spend time on problems, the very best that you can achieve is to get back to the status quo, that is, the place that you had before the problem existed. Once that happens, we tend to be satisfied. Leaders are consummate innovators. Is there room for innovation in the church for a local leader, like a bishop or a stake president and so forth? There isn't a lot. Let me tell you a little story that's kind of interesting with this. My daughter lives in Concord, California, and they had a young, I won't mention the stake or the ward, had a young bishop who was a very bright, brilliant, young, aggressive, progressive fellow, and they loved this bishop. Well, most of them did. The older folks didn't, but the younger crowd sure did. He had heard a choral group at the University of California, where he works, and had invited them to come and sing at the ward sacrament meeting. They were not of our faith, but they came anyway, and apparently gave an extraordinary concert in the sacrament meeting. Those of you who had the music thing earlier this morning will recognize this. The members of the ward were literally charged to tears. It was a magnificent, beautiful, beautiful concert that was extremely spiritual. The bishop was so moved that he stood up after the music was over and said, "Brothers and sisters, I would really like to have us take this feeling back to our homes with our children. We will forget about the other two meetings, no Sunday school, no priesthood or relief society. We'll go home right now. But keep this spirit in your homes," which they all did. And my daughter said, the kids were beautiful. They had the spirit all day, and it was just wonderful. 2 weeks later, the bishop was released because the stake president said, "You cannot do these things." And so there was a situation where the bishop was somewhat innovative or at least different than what is normally thought of as procedure in the church. And because the stake president was primarily a manager type and the bishop was a leadership type guy, you know who won out? The manager did. And so he was released, not just because of that, but some other things. But this was what did it. Leaders take action. The leaders facilitate action for the members. Taking action is one of the most important things that a leader can possibly do. Leaders have a compelling vision, a vision that he will inspire others with. And by the way, I don't necessarily want you to go through these items and correlate your stake president or any general authority with these numbers. That's not why I'm doing it. Leaders thrive on direct communication, which is the stuff of leadership, is direct communication and openness. Now, if you'll go to the next slide, let's contrast that with the management or caretaker style. And I'm not criticizing a manager or caretaker style or administrative type leadership. What I'm saying is that we need both. We do not need only management leadership at the expense of real leadership. Managers are satisfied with the status quo. Managers demand stability and maintenance of the status quo. Managers act on the form that is the how-to, the program, the book, you know, the handbook and procedures. Managers crave control and order. In a bureaucracy, the most important thing is control. I think a manager would rather give up money, fame, whatever else, but he will not give up control because the control in a management situation is what controls the business or the enterprise. Managers impose indirect communications. Now, you think about indirect communications, and I think is what we have in the church now. If I wrote a letter to a general authority, would it be read? No, it would come back down, and my stake president or my bishop would end up with it, and he would then deal with it. There was an article in BYU Today, or whatever the thing comes out of BYU, about a year ago, where Neil Maxwell talked to all of the professors at BYU and implored them not to have direct communication with any of the general authorities, but to go through channels. And channels at that time, from what I gathered, tried to find out, equated with four steps through intermediaries in order to get to the board of trustees. Well, you know as well as I do that any sales people in here? Salesmen? Salesgirls? Women? You have your own business. Is it not true that if you're trying to get into, have a new client or a new contact, that if you don't speak with the head guy, but an intermediary, it's almost impossible for that intermediary to tell or to relate what your business is like to his boss or her boss?
You have to go through an operations manager.
Yeah.
Because this person is doing, not some of his under, you
need to deal with that. That's exactly right. And so it is, I think, with all of us. We would, if we have an idea and we present it to someone, before it gets three or four steps down the line, it's going to be washed down or rejected. People are going to say this is not important because it's not important to them. And that's one of the problems. That leadership has a form of direct communication that is one-to-one. And that's one of the things that we see now in modern leadership in business, is that there are no longer the hierarchies. I think both of us could relate to you literally thousands of business stories all over the country where companies are going more and more to a spaghetti-type operation where there is no hierarchy, to direct communication from, where there are no intermediary layers. One of the largest companies in the world has two layers between the president and the line worker now. And it seems to be working much better. The old hierarchical organizations, I think, are no longer working in our present society. Here we are in an age of the information society, where information seems to be the knowledge business of, to end all things. And yet, as a church, we tend to be shutting off as everybody else is opening up. And that's one of the problems, I think, that not only that we have, but the leaders have, whether they're local leaders or they're in Salt Lake City. And I don't know how I don't know what the answer is to that. I don't have any magic answer to that, because I think they should have in some other place. Any questions so far on the difference between the two? Yes.
Uh-huh. They decide the budget. The people in the congregation decide the budget for that church. Different. The church has no say in what the budget is or anything else. And you don't.
We used to. But that was taken away. Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying.
They can sit down and hash the budget out.
That's right. Well, we used to do this in awards. How many of you remember we would have a situation where we'd talk about the board budget and all those kinds of things? They were fun.
I think if you say me in the award, you have to.
Well, that's true. Although the Relief Society had their own checkbooks at one time and so forth, so they had a little of this. Well, it wasn't much, but they were all. That's exactly right. That's right. Also talking about communications, I'm really fond of a book, and I'd recommend it highly, called The Fifth Discipline, MIT, Peter Senge, I think is his name. They have a big group there, and they have explored open organizations a lot. And he has a couple of things to say, which I thought I'd like to read. He says, and speaking of hierarchical organizations like ours, he says, in such an organization, the top thinks and the local acts. That may not be the way the Lord intended to be. In 1832, at the School of the Prophet in Kirtland, Ohio, the Lord told Joseph Smith that all members should have a turn to speak and to be listened to, that, quote, every man may have an equal privilege, end of quote.
Every man.
I've always said that women would make better bishops than men. Is that not true? Yeah, absolutely true. But I, yeah, it's very funny. Let's equate man with mankind, okay?
But it doesn't say that.
No, it doesn't. In another wonderful book that I really like is a little book called The Glory of God is Intelligence, written by a Jewish rabbi, published by BYU about 10 or 15 years ago. Jacob Neusner is a rabbi, and I think that he has even been at Sunstone Symposiums and talk. I'm not sure, but I think he has. At any rate, he says something in the book that I really like, and it applies to this. He says, and the part of man which is like God is the thing which separates man from the beast. The mind, the consciousness, says Jacob Neusner. When man uses his mind, he's acting like God. And the problem, I think, that we have now is that none of us are asked to use our mind. We are essentially told things to do, and then we march in concert. And I think one of the problems is that many members of the church are either what we call enrolled or whatever, they're not really committed. They're like the good foot soldiers. They are compliant. And there's a great difference between being compliant and enrolled. And by the way, Peter Senge talks about this in his book as well, compared to being real committed. The committed need no manifesto like that, do they? They don't, because they'll do things without being asked. And the wonderful quotation that I've liked the best the last few years that I've read is from a book called, Winning Isn't Everything, by a Keshavian Nair. I don't know if you've ever heard this guy's name. He talks about commitment and how he would turn over things to committed people, because he says, the obedient only do what is necessary. And that's true. I have a home teacher who is a compliant foot soldier. He calls me at the end of every month and he says this, you know my obligation to the bishop. I need to visit you before the end of the month. Can I come over and see you? And I feel every time I say, if you really want to come and see me, please do. But if it's because of an obligation to the bishop, don't. But I don't do that, of course. But isn't that the way it happens a lot? Time is going fast. I'll skip some of the... Harvey? 5 more minutes? Whoa! I told you this is a very long paper, didn't I? Let me talk about the church leader. And if you'll put that little thing up on the wall there, I'd appreciate it. Move it over. That's good. I think this is what most ward functionaries are like. The church likes efficiency, that is, don't let anything fall through the cracks, and that's how people are chosen for leadership positions. Talent for problem solving, that is, maintaining the status quo. I remember all kinds of people in leadership positions in the wards and stakes that I've lived in that are exactly like that. Organization, love for meetings and agendas. You know, those that meet all the time, says Peter Drucker, has a deficient organization. And I think that's true. I have two sons working for real high tech computer companies. One of them works for Hewlett Packard. They have a management by walking around. In other words, they don't have any real meeting rooms. What they do, Hewlett Packard builds these beautiful campus environments, and they're taught to, if you have a problem, get the guy out, take a walk, and talk about it. The reason is that they have very little respect for these stoogie meetings where nothing gets done and everybody talk to each other without any real results. there are companies now where they have meeting rooms with no tables and chairs in modern corporations because they know that if there's no place to sit down, it's not going to take all that long. That's true. I mean, many companies that have this. Other companies now facilitate sofas and chairs and things like that around the restroom because they want the people to chat about business problems on an informal basis rather than the meetings. And so they do this and they encourage these little meetings by the restroom door. And so they facilitate these kinds of things. And of course, we love meetings, don't we? Did I hit that one? Okay, so, and most, of course, people that are called our team players, that is, people that can follow the handbook, doing things the right way, and that have perfect attendance. You know, it's not doing things the right way that's really important. It's finding the right things to do, isn't it? Absolutely. If, you know, I can't count how many bishops' correlation meetings and stake high council meetings and all these things, and we had like 32-page agendas. And the stake presidency would come in, and they would sit down there for 2 hours. They would read through these things that could have just easily been mailed to us. Can you imagine what would happen, and talk about finding the right things to do, if the leadership of the stake, how many are there, you know, if you count the stake presidency, the high council, all the bishoprics, high priest group leaderships, elders quorum presidents, 200, 250 people maybe? Can you imagine just one night a month those people, instead of spending them in meetings, would go out and visit the ward members or the elderly or do missionary work or whatever they could come up with? Wouldn't that be time better spent than in a bureaucratic situation? Or spend it with the families, obviously. Okay, the consequence of not getting this right, I think, is very very important. What I will do is read my summary, and I talk in my paper about the telltale signs that are in the wards and stakes. These things about the church allowing all kinds of viewpoints to be heard is talk. If you get into real ward and stake leadership nitty gritty items, the culture isn't there for that. I've tried 1,000 times in meetings, in classrooms, in organizational situations to, you know, broaden the thinking. And, you know, it just falls on deaf ears. I mean, there's just very little you can do, and it's because of the culture that has been created through this management style, through bureaucracy. I mean, there's no sinister effort in Salt Lake City to make us all conform. I don't think there is. I mean, the brethren don't try to sit up there and talk about how can we make everybody, you know, toe the line like that. I don't think they do that. But it's an inherent problem, I think, in just organizational management. Let me read my conclusion, because there may be some, and I don't know if you'll agree to this, Margaret Wheatley, how many heard her talk last year at the symposium? She's a very bright lady. She wrote this book called Management and the New Science. And I'm very interested in new science myself. I've read a lot about it. And I'm talking about quantum mechanics or quantum science, which is a subatomic type science that is really intriguing a lot of people now. She wrote a book about how to find the answers in that science, and she stated that we're using Newtonian science in our management and organizational ways now, and that we need to change to what is really known today. And just to tease you a little bit, I have one slide at the end that I think is very interesting. But let me read my conclusion. I mentioned her book. There's another book by George Gilder, who reveals some of the aspects of the newfound nature of the universe. He illustrates at the smallest level in the subatomic world. Boy, I've got to learn how to find my place, I'll tell you. Science and the spirit merges into a cross of light where information, that is light and truth, is the only reality. Accordingly, he and scores of other scientists describes how technology is intrinsically bound up with releasing the power of the individual. And we're, of course, talking now about decentralization, which, by the way, the church has tried to do, but the culture isn't there to do it, so it doesn't work. In the microcosm, we are exposed to the universal truth that every human being is inspired and that the power of personal revelation, vision, and knowledge is the basis of our existence. From the microcosm, we eventually perceive, as the gospel illustrates so implicitly, that we need no filter between ourselves and God, and that even his power ultimately rests in our own being, provided, of course, that we meet certain criteria. When Ferguson says that complexity increases by the square number of nodes, nodes meaning the smallest units. If you want to think about this in church terms, you can think of the smallest node being Eliscorm presidency in Nigeria, for example. Of course, there are millions of these small organizations all over the church, and the more there are, the more difficult it is to manage from a centralized base. And I'll read this again. When Ferguson says that complexity increases by the square number of nodes, he makes a case not for centralized authority, but for its impossibility, says George Gilder. Beyond a certain point, he continues, comes the combinatorial explosion. Large bureaucracies tend to stifle their own purposes. Endemic in most organizations, public or private, this problem becomes deadly in the microcosm, that is, in the smallest units. Their centralization becomes deadly in that small Eliscorm presidency in Nigeria, because there's no way that we, from the Wasatch culture, can control their culture. There is no way that we can do it. And I think that the church is trying to find answers to this. I'm sure they are. But they're very, very difficult to come by. I know when I go back to Denmark and I visit the saints in the various wards and so forth, they have a little get-together, they get out their coffee cups, even in church. I mean, the Sanka comes out and the decaf and the whole thing, because they're not going to grab their coffee. In Paris, you cannot have a conversation about sex, because they think differently about that than we do in the church, and they don't want anyone to tell them, you know, what they should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing. And so it is, I think, in all the different cultures. There's a good article somewhere I just read about the culture in some little place in South America that had totally changed church doctrine because it fit with their culture. And Salt Lake can't control this. The Catholic Church haven't been able to control it either. And so the centralized management style of leadership, I don't think is going to work in our century. The pace of change creates too many decisions, too many nodes to be managed effectively in a centralized system. This is the law of the microcosm. The law simply confirms what we learned from quantum physics, that is, how the universe operates. What the new technology says is that complexity grows exponentially. That is, it goes like this the larger you get. And it's very difficult to do something about it. Confirmed by the modern mathematical theory of complexity. Is this up on the wall, hon? You can... There you go. Confirmed by the modern mathematical theory of complexity, it shows, quote, with rigorous mathematical proof, says Peter Drucker, that complex systems do not allow prediction, that we cannot predict what's going to happen in that little Eliscorm presidency in Nigeria. We cannot do it from Salt Lake. No centralized authority can do so. Complex systems do not allow prediction. They are controlled by factors that are not statistically significant. In the microcosm, efficacy grows faster than complexity. That is, the smaller the unit, the more effective it is. Therefore, power must move down to the smallest units, not up to the centralized bureaucracy. The natural law of the microcosm is so powerful and fundamental that it restructures nearly everything else around it, says George Gilder. Rather than pushing decisions up through the hierarchy, the power of the microcosm pulls them remorselessly down to the individual. And I think that's what we need to think about. Thank you very much. By the way, I just saw this. I hadn't had this. There are some of the church organization tables with all the various kinds of hierarchical levels of whatever. You can see them all.
I'm very pleased to be responding to Brother Christensen's fine paper. I want to encourage you to get a copy of it. He only touched the surface of his points. He was articulate, well-researched. It was a rich paper indeed, and he touched on many very important issues. I think it's a paper that should be read by all church leaders. I think they would benefit greatly. So I want to express appreciation for this opportunity to respond to it. Now, I have to admit, as I was reading it, having a number of different kinds of feelings as I was reading it. And so I want to say right off the bat, in my next 10 minutes, actually, you know what the most fun would be for us to do right now? Is to break into groups and say, given the problem that he has very well articulated here, what could local ward and stake leaders do to address these problems? And I bet this... And I bet this group could come up with a lot of things, but we don't have time to have that much fun. So what we'll do instead is do the second best thing. And I just want to throw out some things very quickly because we're anxious to hear from you. But let me just say that I am, I'm not going to hold myself, as I was reading his paper, judging some of my own reactions, I realized I was having some contradictory reactions. And this isn't unusual for me. Life is contradictory. But let me say this. It points out something very important. Organizations are inherently contradictory systems. They are pulled. If you look at the research on the criteria for effective organizational effectiveness, they are competing, contradictory, and often mutually exclusive. Yet they're there. Okay, and every manager and every leader in every organization bears the weight of those contradictions. Every member of the church, every person in church leadership bears the weight of those contradictions, and he articulated them well. I want to say that I am responding from an organizational perspective. From the point of view as a church vis-a-vis other organizations, some of which are ecclesiastical, most of which, however, are private and public and so forth. Also as a faithful member of the church, and also, and let me just say this, as one who is at the lowest end of the organizational hierarchy in the church. As a woman, I have no authority. And even as Stake Relief Society president in the Albany, New York Stake, I had no authority. You see, so I'm always, as all women are in the church, at the lowest end of the hierarchy. I just want to make one other point here, and that is, as I was thinking, over the past 4 years in my teaching, I've been teaching in a program for the State University of New York for mid-career executives returning to school. And I teach courses in organizational theory and behavior and organizational hierarchy and leadership. I realize that in the past 4 years, I have read over 700 essay papers, 5 to 10 pages, by these managerial leaders dealing with their problems. And these individuals are in state agencies, they're in high-tech firms, they're in innovative companies, they're in established firms, they're across the spectrum, and they would have agreed with his paper. They could have read his papers, take out all references to the church, and said, that's me, you see. Because what he was articulating is commonplace. And I should say, no matter how innovative the company is, I've read articles about innovative companies. Then I've interviewed people in those companies. They have the same complaints. We can never speak with the CEO. There are still the status messages of hierarchy. We can flatten organizations, we can reduce those levels, but the fact is, even when there are only two levels, such as in a prison or an insane asylum, as they used to call them, between staff and inmates, that's a hierarchy. And a hierarchy will superiorate some people and subordinate others. That's the nature of it. That's exactly what it does. And this is what happens regardless of how many levels of hierarchy we have. And as soon as you get beyond a certain number of people, you're going to have hierarchy. Hierarchy will develop. They found it among tramps in France. They found it among work groups in Japan. These equal work groups develop hierarchies on their own. Teenage gangs. What's a hierarchy based on? Is it based on, I'm bigger than you are, and I'm going to beat you up, and so I'm the powerful one? Or is it based on expertise? Now, Max Weber did not, the famed German sociologist, who, by the way, Lowell Binion did the most definitive work on, his dissertation in 1933, that several articles in recent years have been published about. But And Lowell understood this very well, and that is that that Weber did not advocate hierarchy, but the thing that bureaucracy did was bring in expertise. We aren't bullying around. It's not by birthright. It's by expertise now. So let me just make a few more quick points, and that is the management and leadership thing. That's a very common formulation. In reality, and I'd say this from the papers I've read, and I've interviewed over 200 managers and judges and court administrators, as well as received surveys from almost 1,400 managers in the past 4 years. Let me say this, that management and leadership dichotomy is fine for thinking about the two things, but it's flawed. In real organizations, a good leader is going to know how to manage, and a good manager is going to know how to lead, no matter what the level is. Okay, if you have a leader who is out there and being innovative but has no idea what's going on back home, it's going to be a short-lived leadership. On the other hand, if you have a manager who all can do can manage but has no leadership skills, then that unit will suffer and often does. And I thought of something very interesting in this paper about the management and leadership. This is not new to ecclesiastical organizations. You know, in the Old Testament, we had the priest versus the prophets. It's the same thing, the same dichotomy there. The prophets were innovative, had new stuff to say. The priest maintained the status quo. But we do need both, as Brother Christensen asserted. We do need both. Let me mention this. Many organizational theorists will tell us that the purpose of organizations is to control people, period. That's the purpose. And anyone who has a business has to be able to control the people's work in that business, or else the business is going to fall. The purpose of organizations, and we won't explore, but I just want to say that's an established purpose of organizations. It's not that I like it, you see. And I need these managers in class. Oh, they don't like being controlled. However, they don't mind controlling people, you see, but they don't like being controlled. See, that's the way it is. Let me just point out, too, he mentioned the Roman Catholic Church. That's widely recognized as the most successful organization on the planet. It's certainly the most long-lived. There are lots of organizations that have been sprung up through the centuries that aren't around anymore. Why not? Roman Catholic Church. And let me see, two more points. One is that the church, I attribute to hierarchical dynamics of approval seeking, for instance. Okay, when we have a hierarchy such as we do, there is every incentive for leaders to seek approval from those above them, and so that's why this good bishop had to be released, you see, because it couldn't be known that in the stake president's stake, that he permitted a bishop to do that and so forth. So approval seeking is fostered in the church. I think that is a dysfunction. I think all organizations stress conformity. It's chilling to see how some of the workplace organizations, the kind of conformity they stress. However, the question we have is, we are an ecclesiastical institution committed to individual growth and freedom and salvation, then how do these organizational dynamics jive with that, you see? And I think that's a real key question. And last, and our what is an organization? You know, we can discuss that to kingdom come, but what is the church? What is the church? Is the church what is church leadership? And I'll tell you what the church is to the members of the Greenwich, New York branch who meet in the Methodist church that was built in 1755 on Sunday afternoon. So the Methodists meet in it Sunday morning. But the people in this branch, like people all over the world, the church is that branch. The church is their branch president. The church is their leaders, the church is the community that's there. That's the church for them. So when we talk about the church, I think a real question is, what is the church for us? And I think we'll find that what the church is will differ for people all over the world. And I think maybe that may be the best hope for it. For a lot of people, the church is not Salt Lake City. Okay, thank you very much.
Our numbers have grown, not surprisingly, and so I actually will field questions. We don't have a whole lot of time. We've got about 15 minutes is on. I'm sure that we could go on and on and on with this topic. But, yes?
I agree with that. I'd like to just draw a very quick experience I had myself. We were sitting in a high council meeting at one time, and being that I was always the rebel of the group, at the end I asked the stake president, I said, look, I said, we have sat here for months on end listening to your agendas. I think we have things to contribute too. Why don't you ever ask us what we think should be done? Being a very wise and very open guy, he's a professor at Cal State Northridge in kinesiology, by the way, and a very close friend, he said, gee, what a great idea. He says, why don't we next time we meet have the meeting, we'll turn the meeting over to you members, and we'll listen. And so that's what took place. The very first person that stood up the following month talked very heartfully about his daughter who had a terrible experience in the wards mutual, the ward that he belonged to. He said, all they do is play broom hockey. She's a little more, you know, academically inclined than most kids, but she wants to participate. But where do I go with this? I mean, she doesn't want to go to this. I need something for my daughter to participate in. This is a disorganized mutual. As a result of that single little admission, the whole stakes mutual program was totally overhauled and built into something that the church would never recognize, but was wildly successful over a period of about 4 years until the next stake president came in and said, this is not the church's program. And, of course, everything went down right down the tube again. But that's a true story. And I think that's, you will find stake president bishops that will do that.
Yes, over here.
I really don't know the answer to that question. I think that personally what I would like to see in the church is a massive educational program within the leadership. When a bishop is called, he's not told much of anything except just to, you know, go with the Spirit and do the best you can and so forth. He has a young woman come up to him who's been raped or some other domestic problem or, you know, he's totally inequipped to deal with those kinds of things. And I think the only way that you can deal with it is to have far more educational programs in the church with leadership than we have now. And I think that you can change the culture, but it takes many years to do it. And I think that's what would have to happen in your situation, where there are a lot of people in the church that want to be told what to do, which is why, you know, the church only, or the only things that happen in the church are when the leadership, you know, really wants it. There are very few people that go out on their own and do their thing and so forth. That's a personal problem. Is that?
I just want to expand that to just one more area, and that is what I would like to see is us not to try to for people to be a certain way in the church. The church has a wide variety of people in it with a wide variety of problems. And it should have troubled people in the church. There should be troubled people in our church. Where else can troubled people go? We should embrace them. And if people don't want to take responsibility, if they want to follow, if that's what they need right now, everyone's in transition, everyone's changing. I think they need to be loved and accepted no matter what they want to do. If they want to take responsibility, they should have that opportunity too. But I think there's a place in the church for a diversity of living styles and thinking styles and behavioral styles. That's all.
Yes.
I have to speak up because I'm a bishop in the Conference State. And I'm a to mean that people are unwilling to exercise it. If we want the responsibility, we've got to step forward and accept it. And that's just...
That's commitment. There isn't very much commitment, even in the church, I think. I mean, real, solid commitment.
Incidentally, I come from New York City, where we have a tremendous amount of diversity in our congregation. As you can imagine, we have a tremendous amount of problems and a real inner city ward there. And our most recent bishop of a year just turned the ripe age of 32 and is terrified. So, point well taken. Anyone else? Yes.
Are you familiar I'm sure you are, with statistics? Do you know what, say, a 1% increase in anything will do over a 20-year period? See, it's phenomenal. It doesn't take an awful lot. And I'm not up here to criticize. I'm here to say that I think we can do a heck of a lot better than what we're doing. And I think that the hierarchical organization is holding a lot of things back that could be done. And if you want to go into that, that's an entirely different subject. But, I mean, that's just a personal opinion. So it's not scientific. Well, you know as well as I do, if you buy a mutual fund at 15% and you hold that for 30 years, you're going to have, say, $500,000. If you have 16%, you're going to have $4 or $5 million. Or, whatever it's going to be, but it's going to be a lot more. And that's why I think that you can't just be satisfied with the status quo. I think you have to reach all the time, just like you teach the children to reach high. But that's my personality, and I don't know if that satisfies. It probably doesn't, but maybe she can.
Well, just to add to what he said, my concern when I think your point is very well taken. The church is obviously doing a lot of things right. What concerns me is how many we lose. Not many how many baptisms, but our inactivity rate is astounding. The people who drop out, the single women. I just, because I got married, I had to step down as stake singles co-chair in our stake. And the number of single women who don't come to church anymore. We're not reaching these people. We've cut them out. And I think this is my concern. I think there are massive numbers that we just don't reach anymore.
I'm not sure about this, so you have to correct me, but it seemed to me that I read the last conference statistics that showed for the first time in our period of time a decrease in our activities in convert baptism, things like that. Like we had 40,000 missionaries out the previous year. We baptized X number. We have 10,000 more missionaries, and we baptize less. Is that a true thing to anywhere you know? Brother Moss, do you know?
I don't think that's accurate as far as baptism is concerned. It might be that the rate of
increase. I think it's the rate of increase that's slower. Okay, that's what it probably is. So, I mean, there are, what I'm seeing around is that there are few signs. I mean, I talk to a lot of people because I like to, communicate, and there seems to be a little undercurrent with a lot of people. A little bit of dissatisfaction going on. People can't quite articulate it, but they know something isn't quite right. And it's because of the bureaucracy and the changes in meeting schedules and all the other things that have been taken. And, people go to church anyway, and they do whatever they have to do. But it's very difficult to articulate this thing, particularly for elderly people. And yet they feel it. My mom is here. She lives here in Salt Lake City. She's 87 years old now, and she's still, going straight and great, and she's a great lady. But she belonged to a little Danish branch that couldn't quite have the organization like the regular wards did because the people are getting a little older and, so forth, so the church disbanded it. Now you've got maybe 100 Danish couples that don't go to church much anymore, and that this is what a bureaucracy will do. And that's what I'm trying to address.
Yeah.
Is the phrase organized religion an oxymoron?
No.
Because it seems to me that that's a follow-up of the question you just asked. I guess the question is, what's the purpose of religion? Is it statistics as to how many people go to church on Sunday, or is it more profound than that? And does the organization, by definition, get in the way
Well, it's obviously an individual and a loaded question. But I can tell you this personally. I like to write, so I just write things down, and I do this for my own sake, not for anybody else's. I'm writing a little paper right now called the Metamorphosis of Eternal Relationships, and it's all about relationships. And I've come to the conclusion that organized religion is absolutely necessary. I don't think it's an oxymoron, and I could give you all kinds of good reasons for that, but obviously we don't have time to do that now. But if you want to talk about
next
it.
Next year.
Let me just point out a quote by sociologist Thomas O'Day when he said, religion needs most and suffers most from institutionalization. If it wasn't for the institution, religion wouldn't be here. If it wasn't for the church, the gospel of Jesus Christ as we know it would not be here. If it wasn't for the Christian church, Christianity would not. Jesus could have walked and taught and did everything he did. If it wasn't for an organization, we wouldn't even know about it. So the dilemma is that we have is that in order for the religion to survive, it's the institution, the organization that enables, that permits the survival of the religion. But I think what you're pointing out, as I sense it, I don't know, but the religion, the institution, the organization can also distort the very religion it's trying to perpetuate. So that's a fascinating topic in and of itself.
Yeah. I have more comments than questions. I spent the last year attending another church called Disciples of Christ. My rebounding programming is Mormonism. Let God direct them that way and let them be professionally trained so that they can spend their life doing that. I see a lot of advantages in professionally trained. A massive education program.
A professionally trained clergy.
Well,
what do you think?
I will respectfully disagree on that. When I said massive training, I don't mean that we should train ministers. I think one of the geniuses of the Mormon Church is our lay ministry, and I would never advocate going away from that.
Why not?
Well, because I think that if you're reading some of the scriptures of the newfound scriptures and the Nag Hammadi scriptures and even the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are clear references in there that all during that period they had a clergy ministry. And I think that paid ministry is something that came with Reformation or with an Nicene Creed. I'm not sure because I'm not a historian. I don't know those kinds of things. But what I'm saying is that I think that the church need to educate and train its leadership more, and it can do that. I mean, after all, organizations all over the world are doing massive amounts of training. The one big thing in organizations is now that you train and train and train and teach and teach and teach and train, and people are constantly going through that in you know, I think that's an inherent problem in church growth. I don't know what the answer is to that. Do you?
No. That's a good answer.
I haven't the foggiest. That's right. One of the things that worry me, I think, the most is that if you take the top tier of the general authorities, say the president of the church, his two counselors, and the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, that only one person has ever had a real job. The other three have grown up inside the church all the way up. And that worries me more than anything else because, like, my own political feeling is I would not vote for a guy who hasn't had to meet a payroll. And I kind of feel the same way about the church. I think it does everybody good to have an outside experience somehow. And, of course, the other person is a lawyer, and he's not really out in the...
Well, thank you very much. There are a few copies of Mr. Christensen's paper, The Ordeal of Church Management, up here, and I'm sure that if you get his address, he may send you one.